This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Why does the word messy have such a negative connotation? Messy desks, messy rooms, messy lives. It shouldn't, according to Tim Harford. In his new book, Messy, The Power of Disorder to Transform Our Lives, he uses research in neuroscience, psychology, and social science to explain why we should embrace messiness instead of resist it, and how the creativity, responsiveness, and resilience we crave rely on the disorder, confusion, and disarray required to produce them. I'm Beth Golay, and on this episode of Marginalia, we move beyond the pages of a book and visit with author Tim Harford about the benefits of being messy. Your book is titled Messy, and the subtitle is The Power of Disorder to Transform Our Lives. And it's divided into 9 chapters: creativity, collaboration, workplaces, improvisation, winning, incentives, automation, resilience, and life. And I was looking through the table of contents, and I found all of these subjects very intriguing, but it was your introduction that really sucked me in. You told a story that took place in 1975. Vera Brandis, who was 17 years old at the time, had invited American jazz pianist Keith Jarrett to perform a late-night concert at the Cologne Opera House. And Jarrett was introduced to the piano he would be playing, and after he and his producer looked at the instrument and played a few keys, his producer announced that Keith wouldn't be playing that night. What happened?
A bit of really serious mix-up with the piano, and the Cologne Opera House staff had delivered a rehearsal model, which was close to being unplayable. It was out of tune, the keys were sticking, the pedals didn't work, and the upper register of the piano sounded harsh and tinny. And so, of course, Jarrett didn't want to play. And Vera Brandis managed to persuade him that they couldn't get a replacement piano, and could he please do his best and go out in front of 1,400 people, packed audience, to just improvise on this terrible, terrible piano. And after some resistance, he agreed. I think he just felt sorry for Vera. She's just this teenager. It's one of her first concerts that she's promoted. And she's going to be facing a riot if Keith Jarrett doesn't play. So reluctantly, he agrees. He says, never forget, only for you. And then he goes out for this late night concert in front of this packed auditorium. And he plays a completely magical piece of music, which was recorded and is now known as the Cologne Concert. It's the best selling piano album in history. It's a masterpiece. But he only played it under sufferance. He didn't go out there thinking, well, this is a great opportunity to deliver the performance of my life. He went out there thinking, well, I've got to do this, but it's going to be a catastrophe. In fact, they only recorded it because they thought it would be a catastrophe. So that got me thinking, what is it about that piano that provoked such a brilliant piece of music? And is there a broader lesson from that?
Well, here, let's listen to that performance.
Think about the specifics of the piano. So basically, Jarrett stuck to the middle of the keyboard because the treble notes sounded really harsh and tinny. But because the piano was a rehearsal model, it was very quiet. So he had to bash down on the keys and really hit it hard. So there's this, the central tones of the keyboard are soothing and ambient. And the piece has this energy and this dynamism. So in a superficial way, that explains why it sounds so good. But I think there's a more general lesson here, which is that often when we are faced with a difficult situation, when we're faced with a random disruption, a distraction, difficult people, all kinds of different obstacles, they can actually induce us to produce a better performance rather than a worse one. There's a whole bunch of reasons why that's true. But that was the starting point for the book, that sometimes even though we don't like it, even though it makes us feel uncomfortable, dealing with a messy situation can actually bring the best out of us.
Thank you. Now, in the chapter on creativity, you note that you're asking the blood in your brain to flow in another direction. And you touch quite a bit on Brian Eno's oblique strategies cards. Can you explain what they are?
So Eno is this zephyr of cerebral chaos who blows backwards and forwards across the frontal lobes of British pop music. And he has worked with everyone from the choreographer Twyla Tharp to the minimalist composer Philip Glass to really big names in rock, in particular Coldplay and U2, and above all David Bowie. He worked on several of David Bowie's best albums from the 1970s. And Eno is a great composer in his own right as well. What Eno does for all of these great musicians he's worked with is that he disrupts their routines. He gets them to do things they don't really want to do. He gets them to try new things. And you can't argue with the results. He produces amazing music. And one of the ways in which Eno does this, and this is a very deliberate strategy, he's thought a lot about this. One of the ways in which he does this is through this deck of cards called the Oblique Strategies, which he developed 40 years ago with a friend of his. And the Oblique Strategies are just about the size of business cards. They're simple and white, and in small, plain black print in the middle of each card, there will be some bizarre instruction, like in total darkness or in a large room at high volume. Or there'll be another one that says, twist the spine. Or there'll be another one that says, switch instrument roles. So you've got the best guitarist in the world in the studio and the best drummer in the world, but unfortunately, the drummer's on the guitar and the guitarist is on the drums. That's the kind of thing that Eno would do to these musicians and produce these amazing results. And he has a theory about why this works. I mean, it's partly just, if you want to get somewhere new, then start somewhere new. That's the simplest way to produce a new result is to start from a different starting point. And that's true in much more mundane settings. We can discuss more mundane settings later if you like. But his other observation is that if you want to produce great creative work, you can't do that if you're bored. And if you're feeling very comfortable with a situation, it's all very familiar, you will bore yourself. Whereas if you're feeling very uncomfortable, if you're feeling stressed and anxious and unfamiliar, you're in unfamiliar territory, then you're paying attention, and that is the friend of creative work, even though it may be very uncomfortable at the time.
You know, you gave quite a few musical references, but there was one non-musical example you gave that really struck a chord with me. You mentioned a group of high school students who were given a teaching handout, and half of the students received the original material, and the other half received handouts that had been reformatted into challenging fonts, like Monotype Corsiva or Comic Sans Italicized. But the students weren't derailed with their studies, were they?
No, they actually did rather better in their end of semester exams. So this research was conducted by a team of psychologists led by Daniel Oppenheimer. And he found that, yeah, the difficult fonts seem to produce better results. Now, I think it's important to put this into context. You know, we must always question a single experiment. Maybe this was a fluke. But I find it fits quite nicely in with many of the other discoveries that I write about in the book, that effectively by slowing the students down a little bit, these more difficult fonts forced them to pay attention. When they were reading handouts in, say, Arial or Times New Roman, which are very standard fonts, they felt very comfortable. They kind of felt like they'd read it already. So they skimmed it. They didn't take it seriously. But if the thing is in Monotype Corsiva, which is a difficult font to read, or Comic Sans Italicized, or Haddenschweiler, which is a very dense Germanic font, when you see those as a student, you think, well, what is this thing? And so you start to pay more attention. You start to draw connections. You're working harder to interpret what you're reading. Now, we should put this into perspective. It wasn't like these things were written in Chinese and the students were required to translate them, or that they were formatted in Wingdings or something like that. I mean, they were legible. They're not impossible fonts to read. It's a modest challenge, but the modest challenge seemed to help. I mean, there's another fascinating example in the same chapter, at least it fascinates me, which is what happens to London's commuters when a strike shut down the public transport system in London, or it shut down elements of the public transport system in London. So London, like New York, London has a subway system called the Tube or the Underground. And most London commuters rely on this system to get to work. Probably 4 out of 5 use some form of public transport to get to work. When it was shut down by a 48-hour strike, many commuters then had to find an alternative route. They had to use the buses. They had to use overground trains. The system wasn't completely disabled, but the people had to find different approaches. And what researchers found when they came back and looked at commuters is that tens of thousands of London commuters found a better route to work during the strike. And then after the strike was finished, they stuck with the new route. So this is just a classic example of what Brian Eno is doing with these oblique strategies cards. You're forced to try a new approach. And as you try a new approach, you find a better way to do things. And it's not necessarily this incredibly mysterious, creative energy. It could just be as simple as, oh, I never realized there was a bus that is a better way for me to get to work. But you know, now when I was forced to look for it, I found it. And now I use it every day. Simple stuff.
In your chapter on workplaces, it has the subtitle, Where Steve Jobs Went Wrong and Why It's Nobody Else's Business Whether You Tidy Your Desk. Talk to me about why the state of your desk is nobody's business. Specifically, maybe about some of the companies who try to enforce the sorted, straightened, shined, standardized, and sustained system of management.
Yes, the 5 S's. So the problem is that some companies have taken ideas from the operating theater or from production lines where very highly precise equipment is put together. So anything from a computer chip to an automobile. And they've taken ideas that work in those environments and said, why don't we insist on the same degree of standardization and neatness in a regular office environment? So we work in an insurance company or we work for a realtor, but we're going to act as though we're on a production line for Toyota. And I mean, this is no doubt quite appealing to some managers. They feel super professional and they feel that if everything looks tidy, then that's the way professionals behave. But there's surprisingly little evidence that this actually helps productivity in a regular office environment. There's quite a lot of evidence that for many people, a messy desk is a perfectly effective way to organize their stuff. And there's amazing evidence on the resentment that these clean desk policies and these standardization policies have on people's environment. So even if a tidy desk is a little bit more efficient than a messy desk, which I have to say, I doubt it, but even if it is, it's not worth the incredible resentment that such a policy produces. There's a study by 2 British psychologists I discuss in the book where they got office workers to try to do regular office tasks in different kinds of office environments. Some were very, very neat. Some were very minimalist and Spartan. Some had pot plants and nice pictures on the walls. But what they found was, what really mattered was not how the office looked. That wasn't such a big deal. What really mattered was, did the people have control over the office environment? If they had control, if they were told, oh, you can arrange the pot plants, you can arrange the pictures however you like, people got loads done, they had a good time. If the experimenter came in and changed things and said, oh, you can't have the pot plant there, I have to move it somewhere else, I'm going to have to move those posters you put on the walls to a different position, it just drove people crazy. They hated it. They hated the experimenter. They hated the office. They hated the tasks. They hated the company. They hated everything. And so just for the sake of some manager's desire for control, you take away all the employees' feelings of control. And it's incredibly counterproductive. And yet many companies insist on doing this.
And then quite the opposite of the strategy was Building 20 at MIT.
Yeah, Building 20 was of course not a strategy. Building 20 was an accident, but it was a wonderful accident. So Building 20 was a temporary building put up during the Second World War to house scientists working on radar. And MIT had to promise to pull it down after the war because it was just a temporary structure made of plywood and cinder block, and it was a fire trap and it was uncomfortable and it violated all the building codes, and of course they were going to pull it down. But then the end of the war came, and then you had the GI Bill, and soldiers come back from the war and they plunge into all of the universities, including MIT, and suddenly you need space. You need teaching space, you need research space. And so Building 20 stays up, and it stays up until the 1990s. And in the half century that this building stays up, despite the fact that it is a complete mess, and anybody would say, well, this is a terrible place to work. In fact, it was an incredibly creative environment. People loved working in it. It saw breakthroughs from Noam Chomsky's linguistics to Harold Edgerton's famous high-speed photographs of bullets going through apples, to some of the first anechoic chambers, these kind of silent rooms where there are no echoes, to one of the first atomic clocks, to advances in solar power, the MIT Model Railway Club, which was the foundation of hacker culture, the first video games, the Bose Corporation. There were so many different innovations came out of that building. And it was because it was a messy, low-status place. And so people were just thrown in there, all higgledy-piggledy, no particular rhyme or reason to why anybody was there. And they were given total freedom to do whatever they wanted, knock down the walls, take out the floors if they wanted. And they would strike up all kinds of unlikely partnerships, because anybody who was doing something low status and interesting was thrown into this building. So when MIT finally said, OK, we're going to have to tear this thing down and build a proper building, the academics who'd worked in it held a kind of funeral service for this building, a memorial service, because they just felt it had been so productive, so creative, even though it was a mess, because it was a mess.
Well, even Jerome Wiesner, MIT's president in 1971, he took up an office there in addition to his formal office, because he said nobody complained when you nailed something to a door.
Yeah, the president of MIT himself says, yeah, I want an office in the worst building in MIT, because actually it's not the worst building in MIT at all. Because it's low status, I can do what I want. And that freedom is more important than working in an office that looks really cool and looks like a magazine would like to come and take photographs of it.
Okay, so in your chapter on improvisation, you mention Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And at the start of his career, he did not embrace improvisation. He would devote 15 hours of work to one sermon. And his first improvisation came when he was asked to organize a boycott of the buses in Montgomery, Alabama, after Rosa Parks was arrested. Is that right?
Yes, he was sort of bounced into that situation. His daughter, Yolanda, had just been born, so he felt obviously that pressure of being a new parent. He felt he didn't have the time. He didn't quite want to take on this responsibility. It felt too weighty for him. He's quite a young man. But he was bounced into it. He had to do it. So suddenly he is the figurehead for civil rights in America, and he is the figurehead of the Montgomery bus boycott. And having all his life been a very strong public speaker, but a very, very carefully, rigorously prepared public speaker, he has to go and give the speech of his life in front of the largest audience of his life, and the TV cameras and the newspapers from across the country. And he has to give that speech. He's got 15 minutes to prepare. He spends 5 minutes of those 15 minutes praying, and 5 minutes panicking, and 5 minutes writing out some bullet points, just a few things he's going to say. And then he drives to the venue for this speech. It's the Holt Street Church. And he gives the greatest speech of his life. And people who knew him well, who had seen him preach every Sunday, said it was amazing. Nobody had any idea that Martin Luther King was a man who could speak with so much force. And when you listen, you can listen to the transcript, listen to the recording of the speech, it's on YouTube. There are problems with the speech. There are lines that don't quite work. There are mistakes. The ending is quite limp. But the overall effect is tremendously powerful, because he was experimenting with how to express himself. And he was getting feedback live from the audience and understanding what they were responding to and what they were not responding to, and adjusting his remarks accordingly. And that willingness to let go and to improvise made him an enormously powerful speaker. And there's a much more famous example of that, which is the I Have a Dream speech at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington.
Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities. Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend.
The second half of that speech is improvised. And in fact, the whole riff about I have a dream. He's talked about this in churches, but it's not in the script. He never intended to say it. But then he realized that that was the right metaphor for the moment. It was improvised.
I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal.
Yeah, he had that speech. It was called Normalcy Never Again, and he had it scripted. But then once he improvised, it became the I Have a Dream speech.
Yeah, it was scripted because he had all kinds of constraints around him in terms of timing, very delicate politics of the civil rights movement at the time, lots of different factions, lots of different things to consider. But in the end, he's 7 minutes into his speech and he realizes it's not quite right. And there are lines in front of him that are dull and limp and that he doesn't want to deliver. And so he steps away from that speech. And he tries a biblical metaphor, and then he hesitates. And the people behind him on the stage at the Lincoln Memorial, they've got the script. They know he's off script. They know he's improvising. And the gospel singer, Mahalia Jackson, who has been with Dr. King as he's spoken at churches around the country, she's heard him talk about this dream sometimes that he has, and it's a very powerful idea. And she yells out to him, "Tell him about the dream, Martin." And in that moment, he realizes, yeah, that I've got to talk about the dream, not the script. I've got to talk about the dream. And of course, it's a tremendously powerful moment in the history of civil rights in America. And it's an improvised moment.
A really good conversation is mentally demanding. And to know when it's appropriate to go off script and to improvise, such, you know, just like Martin Luther King Jr. did in that speech. You also mentioned, you know, back to music, Miles Davis. In 1959, he gathered a group of jazz musicians in a Manhattan church that had been converted into a recording studio.
Very messy space, by the way.
Talk about what happened. I mean, they had two recording sessions, and they ended up with an album.
And they ended up with the album. Up with Kind of Blue, which is a record that changed the course of the 20th century. And one thing that struck me about the recording was the way in which Miles Davis basically took the first full take almost every time. There might be some small technical issue, some small, you know, little sort of fluff, or the microphone's not quite working, and then they'd restart. But once they got going, Davis would just go through to the end. And every now and then they'd record an alternative take, but they just wouldn't use it. And that's true even when it seemed that someone had made a mistake. So in the really iconic opening track of Kind of Blue, which is called So What, if you know Kind of Blue, there's this duet between the piano and the double bass, and the double bass carries the tune, very unusual. And then a short distance into that piece, Jimmy Cobb, the drummer, swaps his brushes for sticks, and he kind of whacks the drum kit a bit too hard. It's a mistake, and he's on record as saying he thought that Davis would stop. But Davis just kept going, and it becomes this electrifying moment. Davis was willing to accept the imperfections because it made the music sound much fresher and more exciting. There's one other thing that I think is absolutely amazing about Kind of Blue, which is that Miles Davis afterwards said, yeah, that wasn't what I was aiming for. I just think that's magnificent. And people say to him, well, you're saying it's not a great album. He's like, no, I'm not saying it's not a great album. I'm just saying it wasn't what I was aiming for. He wanted it to sound a little bit more African. And I think the confidence to let something ride, to record an entire album that is not actually what you wanted, because you recognize in the moment, actually, this is sounding good. that's something special. Most of us want to exert control. So we say, well, this isn't working out the way I wanted it. I need to change it. Rather than stepping back and going, well, hang on, maybe even though it's not working out the way I wanted, maybe it's working out really well. By the way, that's also something Brian Eno told me about David Bowie. He said that David Bowie was brilliant at stopping. You might be 90% through a brilliant piece of music and there'd be some mistake and the mistake would be interesting. And Bowie would say, we need to listen to that. We need to embrace that and we need to expand on that. And he was happy to put to one side the project that was nearly finished and instead focus on the interesting accident, because that's where the creativity came. But very unusual.
You know, what struck me about Kind of Blue is it took them 9 hours to record it. And by comparison, you said it took the Beatles 700 hours to record Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And so perfection comes at a cost sometimes.
It does. And of course, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band is also a brilliant album. Well, I have to admit, I listen more often to Kind of Blue. But yeah, it doesn't necessarily take hundreds and hundreds of hours of work. It doesn't necessarily take this striving for perfection, striving for control to get it exactly the way you wanted it. That is not always the path to greatness. Sometimes when we let go a little bit and we embrace the imperfection, we get something brilliant. And that's true if you're a musical genius like Keith Jarrett or David Bowie or Miles Davis. But I think that's also true in the everyday interactions we have as parents, as friends, as colleagues. They're just those conversational interactions. We're all very, very good at conversation, but very often we won't let go and embrace a conversation, and instead we'll try and control it, and then we lose what makes it special.
There was also a mention of improvisation in a practical business application, and it happened in the social media department of one of the United Kingdom's largest phone companies. Is that pronounced O2?
Yes, they're pronounced O2. You have it right.
So what happened at O2? They had a power outage, is that right?
So yes, O2 is a really big cell phone provider. It's the equivalent of, I guess, something like Sprint or Verizon in the US. They had a problem. The problem took out many of their phones, and also they provide internet, and it took out internet as well. And it started in London, and it spread across the UK and lasted quite a long time. And of course, people took to Twitter to complain. People are on Twitter and they're yelling at O2 saying, get it sorted, my phone doesn't work, my internet doesn't work, and they're complaining, complaining, complaining. Now the natural response, I think, if you're O2 is just to push out almost like some kind of human auto replier, a bunch of tweets that basically say, we're very sorry for the disruption, and you know, here is the status update, and we're working on your problem, or something like that. But instead, one of the people working in the social media team decided he was going to do something a bit riskier and to start joking. And particularly when people came in with really abusive statements, like, I can't possibly actually say some of the tweets that came in, they're far too rude. And he would just sort of bounce back with kind of jokey apologies and a very, very, a real lightness of touch. And something amazing happened, which is that as people watched this, O2 changed from being this big faceless corporation who's letting its customers down to being this very human organization who's trying their best, and there are a whole bunch of bullies out there on Twitter, and they're responding to the bullying with good humor. There's this one point where, you know, somebody tweeted how what a great job the O2 social media team were doing, and the O2 social media team just tweeted back, I need a hug. And you just had that sense of vulnerability. It worked incredibly well. But that required real bravery on the part of the social media team, because their boss was locked in the boardroom with the chief executive of O2 trying to decide how to respond to this big technical crisis and what press releases to put out and all of this. They haven't got time to pay attention to social media. But there was enough of a sense of freedom and the willingness to experiment, the willingness to take a few risks.
And it took, you know, a level of trust, even of the manager, you know, to trust the people who are at the keyboard, you know, typing the 140 characters, to trust that they're they're not going to step over a certain line and really embarrass the company.
Absolutely. And of course, sometimes things do go wrong. So there's no, I'm not saying, oh, and this is always the right way to do things. The manager's name was Nicola Green. I talked to her and she said, yeah, it's a very fine line. And it could easily have gone wrong, but it didn't. And to this day, their policy is that they don't micromanage the social media department. They coach them, they encourage them, and every couple of weeks, they will sit down and they'll just have a review of what have you been tweeting and what do we need to change? And it's a much lighter touch. And I think they're willing to take that risk. There is, of course, a risk that at some stage somebody says something stupid and it looks really bad for the company. But they're willing to trust the judgment of their employees and feel that that human judgment is more powerful than this, you know, very risk-averse corporate handoff that you're just blocking all human interaction because you're afraid that something will go wrong.
Okay, well, I'm going to move ahead to the last chapter, life, because in it you talk about inboxes and calendars and organization, and we're at the height of resolution season. What do folks need to keep in mind during this time of great hopefulness, yet depressing failure?
Well, I think that it is possible to try to over-organize. And it's possible to over-organize your desk. It's possible to over-organize your email. It's possible to over-organize your calendar. And when you do that, frustration is often down the line. So one of the studies that I talk about in the book, which really stuck with me, was conducted by a psychologist called Steve Whitaker, who specializes in how people organize their documents, their physical documents and their digital documents. And what Whitaker, he was working with a colleague called Julia Hirschberg, what the two of them found was people who keep piles of paper on their desks are actually often very effective at managing their paper. They know where things are. They have an active archive full of documents they actually use. And they make good use of the waste paper bin, because if you think about a pile of paper on your desk, it's self-organizing. So the stuff you're not touching sinks to the bottom. The stuff that you keep using stays at the top. And every now and then you pick up the pile of paper and you go, well, this bottom half can just go in the trash can. So in a very simple, practical way, it looks disorganized, but it's actually perfectly functional. On the other hand, people who kept very tidy desks, they tended to have very large filing systems full of documents that they didn't really know where they were, because they hadn't really understood the filing protocol when they made it, because they're just trying to get the stuff off their desk. So you've got a huge filing system full of low-value paper that probably should have been thrown away, should have been recycled, but instead it's in some archive somewhere. They didn't really have a good sense of what they had to do, and they were frustrated. But on the other hand, at least their desk looked very tidy. So I think this is very common. I mean, there's a similar story to be told for email. There's a similar story to be told for calendars. But when we try to over-organize in a very formal sense, we often end up setting up systems that just don't work terribly well. They're not practical for everyday use. And the real lesson I learned was reading Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. And Benjamin Franklin, of course, one of the most productive and remarkable and creative and original people in history. And yet he was constantly beating himself up about the fact that his desk wasn't tidy. And even towards the end of his life, he reckoned he'd managed to improve his character and embrace all kinds of moral virtues over the course of his life. But he was frustrated because he'd never managed to get tidy. He'd never managed to get orderly. And yet, of course, it's Benjamin Franklin. How could he possibly have achieved any more with his life? How could he possibly have been a more influential or a more productive person? And the idea that if only he'd had some more filing cabinets and some more manila folders, everything would have been fine, it's ridiculous. So there's a lesson for us all, that we judge very often on appearances. We feel that things are messy, things look bad, and therefore they're actually out of control. But very often, a messy desk is a perfectly productive desk, a messy inbox is perfectly productive, and a messy person is very often perfectly productive too.
That was Tim Harford, author of Messy, The Power of Disorder to Transform Our Lives, which was published by Riverhead Books. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at kmuw.org or through iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Nadia Foe. Our engineer is John Cyphers, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.